Don't listen to them for a second. Seriously, just turn off the radio. We don't have to hurry here. Do you think you're doing the right thing? They were visibly closer now than they had been. They weren't accelerating toward him, but they weren't braking either. Havelock's HUD made the calculation. They'd be at the Rosie or the Barb or the tether between them in about 20 minutes.
You guys need to slow down now, Havelock said. You're still my people, and I don't want to hurt any of you.
The radio clicked to life. The chief engineer's voice was thick with anger and contempt.
Don't try to play that on us, you traitorous bastard. Your little friend's PDCs are powered down. We saw that before we dropped. You think we're stupid? We have orders to bring you and the Belter bitch back to the Israel and put you both in the brig.
Orders?
Straight from Murtry.
Because, Havelock figured, it was precedent. RCE would be able to assert that it had protected its claim down to the last minute. Murtry's legacy would be that he hadn't given up a centimeter. Not on the ground, not in space, not on the abstract legal battlefield. Nowhere. There was a time, not that long ago, when Havelock would have thought there was a kind of hard purity in that. Now it just seemed weird and kind of pathetic.
Okay, he said. You're right. The PDCs are down. But you haven't thought the rest of this through. I am outside the ship. I'm armored. I have an integrated HUD and a weapon that can reach any of you right now. None of you have any cover. The reason you guys are alive right now is because you're my guys, and I don't want any of you hurt.
He watched them react. It was less than he'd hoped. The Rosie bucked again. The bolt of the railgun and the attacking streaks of energy from the moons. Havelock reacquired the targets. It took a fraction of a second for the HUD's alert to make sense to him. Four of the targets were moving, fast. Four of the gas tanks, accelerating hard, a cloud of thin mist flowing out behind them as whatever residual vapor had been trapped in it froze into snow.
You've got incoming,
Alex snapped in his ear, and Havelock lifted his gun. One of the missiles was clearly flying off course, a vicious spiral wobble leading it down toward the planet. He took aim at one of the three remaining and blew holes on both sides of the tube. The improvised missile wobbled as whatever steering device the Israel's engineers had put on the back struggled to use the last of the escaping ejection mass to correct the course, but the venting gases were too destabilizing. It drifted up and began to turn. He shifted to the two remaining targets. He wasn't going to have time to get them both, but he managed to sink two rounds into the one that was heading straight toward him, trying to knock out the payload. The one remaining tube hit the Rosie's skin 8 meters to Havelock's right, and the world went white. Something pushed him, and something hurt, and the sound of his suit radio was still there, but it was faintly distant. His body seemed very large, like it had expanded to fill the universe, or the universe had shrunk down until it fit in his skin. His hands seemed a very long way away. Someone was shouting his name.
I'm here,
he said, and it felt like hearing a recording of himself. The pain started ramping up. His HUD was flashing red medical warnings, and his left leg was frozen stiff and unbending. The stars spun around him, new Terra coming up from below him and then spinning up past his head. For a moment, he couldn't find the Rosinante or the Barbapicola. Maybe they were gone. He caught a passing glimpse of the Israel, though, far off to his right, and so small he could almost have mistaken it for a tightly packed constellation of dim stars. His HUD spooled up a fresh warning, and he felt a needle fire into his right leg. A cold shudder passed through him, but his mind seemed to clear a little.
Havelock?
Alex said.
I'm here, Havelock said. I'm not dead. I think I've been knocked off the ship, though. I seem to be floating.
Can you stabilize?
I don't think so. The suit may be malfunctioning. Also, I seem to have taken a lot of shrapnel in my left leg and hip. I may be bleeding.
Do you have containment? Havelock, are you losing air?
It was a good question, but his gorge was rising. The spinning was making him sick. If he puked in the helmet, things would go from bad to worse very, very quickly. He closed his eyes and focused on his breath until he thought he could stand to look again. When he did, he kept his gaze on the unshifting images of the HUD readout.
I have containment. I can breathe.
He heard Naomi sigh. It sounded like relief. He was flattered. The red dots of the militiamen spun past in the corner of his eye. He couldn't tell if they were still getting closer or if they'd stopped. Something bright happened in the atmosphere. The railgun firing again. The planet rose up from below him and disappeared over his head.
Hang on, Koyo, Baja said. I'm coming out.
Belay that, Havelock said.
The guys from the Israel have more of their improvised missiles. They have guns. Stay inside.
Too late, Baja said. Already cycled out the lock. I just need to... Shit, that's bright.
Havelock twisted to the left, finding the Rocinante at last. The explosion hadn't thrown him as far as he'd thought, but he was on the drift now. Every breath took him farther from the metal and ceramic bubble of air. He wondered if he stayed out here whether his body would outlast the ships. His air supply wouldn't. The improvised missile had left a bright scar on the Rosie's outer hull, but didn't look like it had made any holes.
Tough little ship.
Huh, Baja said. Well, they're shooting at me.
Get back in the ship, Havelock said.
I will, in a minute. Now where did you?
Ah, there you are.
The grapnel struck his left arm, the gel splashing out and hardening in almost the same moment. At the first tug, his right leg shrieked in pain, but the vectors were such that his uncontrolled spinning slowed. The red dots of the militia were much closer now. Baja was in real danger of being shot, and there were still 8 more improvised missiles. The Rocinante jumped. The railgun path through the high atmosphere glowed. Had it really only been 5 minutes? He had to have missed a couple of rounds. Or maybe getting blown out into space just changed how he experienced time. Or maybe he'd seen them and then forgotten.
Don't pull me too fast, Havelock said. You're going to have to put just as much energy into stopping me once I'm there. I could knock you off.
Or smash against the hull. He didn't say.
I've been in low G more than I haven't, Baja said,
a real amusement in his voice.
Don't worry yourself.
The slow spinning Rocinante came closer, Havelock's own spin making it seem like the universe and the ship and his own body were all in slightly different realities. Baja was a darker blot against gray ceramic and metal. Havelock's HUD cheerfully informed him that his blood pressure had been stabilized. He hadn't realized that it was unstable. The suit's attitude jets were still offline, but Baja jumped up to meet him before he touched the deck, wrapping arms around his shoulders in a bear hug while Baja's suit slowed them.
You need to get inside, Havelock said as his left mag boot locked against the hull.
I was about to say the same to you, Baja said. How much shrapnel did you take?
Havelock looked at his leg for the first time. The suit was dotted with emergency sealant, the result of a dozen holes at least.
All of it, apparently. I've got fast movers, Alex said.
Havelock turned, rifle up, ready to shoot the missiles down before they reached him, or die trying. It took a few seconds to find them. The green dots weren't heading for him. They were tracking down toward the planet. Toward the barb.
Okay, he said. Hold on.
I think they're still shooting at you, Naomi said.
He moved forward, his leg not painful now so much as eerily numb. The shifting of the Rocinante was throwing off his aim. His HUD showed a lock, and he pulled the trigger. One of the missiles exploded.
Baja was hunched down, hands and legs against the decking, a stream of obscenity coming from him sounding like a chant.
Havelock tried to move his mag boots, but he couldn't get them to respond. The Rossi bucked.
The crew of the barbs braced, Alex said. First impact in...
A new brightness bloomed below them. Havelock felt it. The impact traveling through the tether to the Rossi to his boots almost instantaneously. Through the radio, he could hear Alex groan.
Okay, Naomi said, this is a problem.
Below them, the Barbapiccola was starting to tilt. The force of the explosions just enough to give it a little velocity, a tumble so slow he could almost pretend it wasn't there. Almost. Not quite. The webwork of the tether was shredded. Two strands still held, but the others were drifting. One was cut in two. The others might have broken free of their foot supports or pulled the supports off the skin of the ship. He wasn't sure. New Terra was so large below, it filled his field of vision. A wave of vertigo washed over him, and he had the near hallucinatory sense that the planet was a monster, rising up through a vast ocean to swallow them all.
Alex, Naomi said, drop the cable.
No!
Baja shouted at her.
Not responding, Alex said. The release seems to be damaged.
The Rossi bucked, and the tether snapped taut.
Cease firing, Baja shouted. Stop firing the railgun.
Sorry, Alex said. It was on automatic. It shut down now.
I'm going to the barb, Baja said. I've got my welding rig. Maybe something I can do.
That's not going to work, Naomi said. Just cut it.
The Barbapiccola was a good 10 degrees off the stable orbit she'd had, tumbling.
I'm not coming back in, Baja said, and I'm not cutting it. I gotta go look.
You remember they're still shooting at you, right? Naomi said.
I don't care, Baja said.
I'll cover him, Havelock said. I can do that.
Can you move?
Havelock consulted his HUD. His shredded leg was immobilized and under pressure to contain the bleeding. One of his attitude jets had been holed. The air in his suit smelled sharp, like melting plastic. That couldn't be a good sign.
Not really, no. But Baja can get me to cover. The outer airlock hatch on the Rossi, maybe. I can stay there and snipe.
Hurry then, Naomi said. They're still getting closer, and eventually they'll get to a range they might hit something.
Havelock disengaged his mag boots and turned toward the belter.
All right. If we're going to do this, let's go.
Baja clapped a hand on Havelock's arm and started dead-hauling him down the ruined side of the ship. The pockmarks and bright spots where the debris of the shuttle had struck were everywhere, now joined by the scar of the improvised missile. A soft, white plume curved into the void where something was venting. Time seemed to skip, and he was at the airlock's outer door. It was open, waiting for him. The red dots showed that his men were still 10 minutes away. The barb was above him now, and the planet above that. Not a beast rising to devour him, but a whole clouded sky falling down to crush him.
Are you all right? Baja said. You can do this?
I'll live,
Havelock said, and immediately realized how completely inappropriate that had been to say.
I'm all right. Lightheaded, but my blood pressure's solid.
Okay then. I'll be right back. Don't let those sons of bitches screw this up any worse. I'll do my best, he said. But Baja had already launched himself up along the tether. Havelock checked his rifle, his HUD. He still had to adjust for the Rossi's spin, but he found the little red dots quickly.
All right, guys, he said. You've made your point. Now let's just dial this back. There's still time. I don't want to hurt anybody.
The words were surreal, like a poem from some other century, a litany for de-escalating conflict. No one really appreciated how much of security work was just trying to keep things under control for a few more minutes, giving everyone involved in the crisis a little time to think it all through. The threat of violence was just one tool among many. And the point was not making things worse. If there was any way at all, just not making things worse. It occurred to him that Murtry was actually really bad at that part of the job. His HUD marked a fast-moving object, a bullet or a slow meteor. From the angle, probably a bullet. Another one was moving on a track to pass Baja. It was going to miss, too, but not for much longer.
All right, Havelock said, raising his rifle. I'm counting to 10, and anyone that's still on approach, I'm going to have to put a hole in you. I'll try to just disable your suits, but I'm not making any promises.
The red dots didn't change their vectors. It was strange. He'd come all this way, faced all these dangers. He was falling by centimeters into a planet, and struggling for a few more minutes or hours of life. And the thing that worried him most was still that he was going to have to shoot somebody. Chapter 50. Elvie. The cart had been designed for use on rough terrain and shipped out to a planet without roads. It wasn't smooth, but it was fast, and the roar of the generator and the whirring of the motors had made a kind of white noise that Elvie's brain tuned out after the first few hours, leaving her in something like silence. And all around them, the ruins of New Terra rose up and then passed away. The storm that had scoured First Landing into scraps and mud hadn't been local. All of the landscapes they passed through were shattered and drowned, but they were still fascinating, still beautiful. A forest of thin red bodies halfway between trees and gigantic fungi lay on their sides, the cart's wheels leaving tire tracks across their flesh. Flying creatures, no larger than her splay-fingered hand, fell into line behind the cart for hours, attracted by the noise or the movement of the spray of atmospheric hydrocarbons. She wondered how the frail creatures had survived the planetary disaster. When night fell, three vast columns of luminous dots rose up into the sky, like skyscrapers built from fireflies. She didn't know if they were organisms, like the mimic lizards, or artifacts, like her butterflies. A huge animal, as tall and wide across as an elephant, but segmented like a caterpillar, lay dead and rotting along the crest of a low hill, structures like two interlocking sets of ribs crossing its massive sides, and gnat-small carrion eaters flying around it like a fog. A silver and blue structure rose from a pool of grayish rainwater, collapsed, and rose again. It could have been anything, but she could only see its behaviors as play, splashing in puddles. It was all she could do to keep from stopping and looking at it all. A whole biosphere, or two or three, passed by her, teasing and hinting. She wished she could have seen it all before the storm. At best now, they would be able to guess at what had come before and see what came after. She took consolation by reminding herself that that was always true. All of nature was a record of crisis and destruction and adaptation and flourishing and being knocked back down again. What had happened on New Terra was singular and concrete, but the pattern it was part of seemed to apply everywhere, and maybe always. Even the aliens that had made the artifacts, the protomolecule, the rings, had suffered some vast and cosmic collapse. At dawn, the three of them shared the last of their food. There was still enough water to last a few days, but they would be hungry ones. And after that, she guessed they'd try to find something on the planet that they could stomach. They would fail and die. Unless Holden really could turn the reactors back on and drop something from the ships. A steep-walled canyon blocked their way, the erosion of centuries exposing strata of rock as even and unvarying as the pages of a book. It took the cart's expert system half an hour to find a path down and back up. When she had mentioned how lucky they were they hadn't hit anything like a mountain range, Faez had laughed. "You'd need tectonic plates first," he'd said. "This planet doesn't have mountains. It has hemlines." None of them talked much. The noise of the cart drowning out anything short of shouting. But even if they'd been driving in silence, she didn't have the sense that Amos Burton would have spoken. He spent the day and a half of travel sitting at the cart's front edge, legs folded, his eyes on his hand terminal or the horizon. She thought there was a growing anxiety in the man's broad face, fear for Holden and for the ships above them and the planet all around. But she could also have been projecting her own feelings on him. He had that kind of face. In some places, the tracks of the other cart, Murtry and Way's cart, had wandered off on a different heading from their own. Sometimes the tracks got lost in the soft mud or vanished as they crossed wide, wet expanses of stone. But it always returned, the doubled track of their tires leading the way north into the wilderness. The headlights showed a swath of gravel and pale yellow snail-like organisms that were crushed under the cart's wheels. The air was colder, either because they were heading north or because the permanent cloud cover was keeping the energy of the sun up away from the planet's surface. Elvie had dozed as much as the emptiness in her belly permitted, her head on Fias's lap. Then they traded, and he dozed in hers. Her dreams had been of Earth, and trying to guide a pizza delivery service through the hallways of her university lab. She woke, knowing that something had changed. But it took her a long moment to realize what. The cart was silent. She sat up, rubbing her eyes. The other cart was in the headlights, spattered with mud and scarred along the side where it had scraped against something harder than its alloy siding. Amos dropped down and walked slowly around it twice, once looking at the cart and once looking out into the darkness. "What is it?" she asked. "Is everything okay?"
"The motors are burned out," Amos said as he hauled himself back up to the cart bed. "Got mud in the axles and didn't clean it out. Wherever they went from here, it was on foot."
"Are we close to Holden?"
"Oh yeah," Amos said, holding up his hand terminal. "This was the last blip we saw. It was short, but it gave us a pretty good lock on his position. We'll move toward it and hope he pops up again soon."
The map didn't give her a sense of scale, but there were two indicators on it, one for them and the other for the captain.
"If I'm right, we're getting right toward the end of this, and we're still the ones with the wheels. You two'd better lie down on the deck from here on in."
"Why?" Faez asked.
"Case they decide to shoot someone," Amos said, restarting the generator.
Over the roar, she didn't think Amos heard Faez say, "All right, that makes sense." But she did. It was still the small hours of the morning, the long stretch between midnight and dawn, when they came to the structure. At first, it was only a glittering in the darkness, like a bit of starfield. For a time, she thought it might be a break in the clouds. But the closer they came, the more obvious it became that it was something else. In the darkness, the details were hard to make out, but it seemed to share the same almost organic architecture with the ruins back in First Landing, but a couple orders of magnitude larger. She had the sense of being at the edge of one of the huge industrial ruins of the European West Coast, a place where something world-shatteringly huge had once made its power felt, and now had left its carapace behind. When the first pale flakes of snow filtered down through the headlights, she thought at first they were ashes.
"Is that where we're going?" Fayez asked.
"Think so," Amos said. "We haven't had a solid update on the captain in a couple hours, and that up there's about where the last reading came. Figure once you get inside, the signal don't penetrate."
"Or it ate him," Fayez said. "It could have just eaten him."
"Captain'd be a tough meal to swallow," Amos said.
The cart rolled on, moving toward Holden's last known position. Huge black spikes rose out of the ground, some of them swiveling to track their passage. The snow thickened, sticking to the ground and the cart. The structure remained clean, though, the white melting away. "It's warm," Elvie thought, and couldn't explain why she found the idea so unnerving. The cart passed under an archway 10 meters high and into the structure itself. The snowfall stopped. All around them, the walls glowed, filling the space with a soft, shadowless light. The air was warmer and smelled of something sharp and acrid, like alcohol fumes, but harsher. The cart shifted one way and then another, hunting for the last fading traces of Holden's electrical scent before giving up and stopping. Amos flipped it over to manual and took direct control. The pathways moved in swirls and loops for a time, then broadened, opening. The roof of the place was lost in darkness, and long tubes of what could have been conduits or vasculature rose up out of the earth and flowed together, inward, forward, toward whatever the functional heart of the place had been. The cart slowed. Amos took a shotgun from the deck and fired it. The report echoed.
"What are you shooting at?"
Elvie asked. Amos shrugged.
"Nothing in particular. Just thought, you know, loud."
He cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted,
"Captain! You out there? Holden!"
"Are we sure he's in here?" Fayez said.
"Nope,"
Amos said, then went back to shouting,
"Captain!"
A figure stepped from behind a massive machine 50 meters in front of them. It was the size and shape of a human, and Elvie felt a moment's disorientation at how utterly out of place it seemed. Amos took a fresh grip on the shotgun and angled toward it. The figure stood, feet shoulder-width apart, hands at its sides as the cart approached. When they were within 10 meters, Amos shut the generator down.
"Hey there," he said,
his voice open and friendly and insincere.
"Hey yourself,"
Wei answered, lifting her chin. Amos dropped from the side of the cart, his shotgun in his hand, almost as if he'd forgotten it was there. Elvie looked at Fayez, who shrugged. She slid down to the ground, moving forward slowly. She kept her hand against the front tire, the tread warm against her palm but cooling.
"What are you up to?"
Amos asked.
"Work,"
Wei said, nodding to the vast structure all around them.
"RCE's got a claim on all this. I'm just making sure no one infringes on it."
"Meaning the captain?"
"Meaning anyone," Wei said.
Her voice was harder now.
"Well, it's a fucking ugly place, if you ask me."
"It is."
"We really gonna do this?" because I think it'd be a hell of a lot more fun for me to get Holden and you to get Murtry, and we all see if there's not some way for the doc back there to find something with alcohol in it on this mud ball.
Yeah, that does sound like fun, Wei said. But I'm on duty.
Faez came up from behind Elvi, his arms crossed over his chest. His eyebrows were pulled together in distress.
So, thing is, Amos said, yeah, Holden's in there someplace, and I'm figuring Murtry's in there looking for him.
Could be.
So when I get back up there and drive on by...
You don't want to do that, Amos.
My orders are no one goes in.
Hop back on and head the other way, you and me have no problems. Try to infringe further on RCE property, and I'm going to have to shoot you.
Amos rubbed his scalp with his left hand. The shotgun in his right seemed larger now, like the threat of violence gave it significance, and the significance gave it weight. Elvi found herself breathing in quick, short gasps, and thought for a moment that something had changed about the air itself, but it was only fear.
Captain's in there trying to get the reactors back on, Amos said.
Then he's trespassing and he'll have to leave.
Wei's stance softened for a moment, and when she spoke there was something like sorrow in her voice. Not the thing itself, but like it.
When it's time to go, there's worse ways than dying at your post.
Amos sighed, and Elvi could see his shoulders slump.
Your call, he said, raising the shotgun.
The report came from behind them, and Amos pitched forward.
Down! Murtry shouted at their backs,
and Elvi hunched as automatically as a reflex. Faez was pressed against her on one side, the massive tire on the other. The shotgun boomed at the same time as the sharp crack of a pistol sounded. Elvi looked out, and Wei was on the ground, her arms thrown out at her sides. Amos was struggling to his knees. His back was to her, and there was blood on the back of his neck, but she couldn't see where it was coming from. Murtry strode past her, firing his pistol 2, 3, 4 times. She could see Amos's armored back quiver with every shot. Murtry wasn't missing. Her own scream sounded high and oddly undignified. Murtry rounded the cart as Amos turned with a roar. The shotgun fired 3 times, the concussions beating at the air. Murtry stumbled back, but didn't fall. His next shot drew a small fountain of blood from Amos's thigh, and the big man collapsed. Murtry lowered his gun and coughed.
Dr. Okoye, Dr. Sarkis, he said.
The armor over his chest was shredded. If he hadn't been wearing it, Amos's blast would have blown the man's heart back out through his spine.
I have to say I'm disappointed by your decision to come here, and your choice of company.
Amos was gasping, his breath ragged. Murtry stepped delicately across to him and shoved the shotgun away. The metal hissed against the strange, chitinous flooring.
You shot him, Faez said.
Of course I did. He was threatening the life of one of my team,
Murtry said, walking over to Wei.
He sighed. My only regret is that I was unable to save Sergeant Wei.
Tears filled Elvi's eyes. She felt sobs shaking her. Amos lifted a hand. The thumb and forefinger were missing. The bright pink bone showed through the blood. She looked away.
What are you talking about? Faez said, his voice was shaking.
Dr. Sarkis, you have something you'd like to add? Murtry said, slipping a fresh magazine into his pistol.
You set this up. You set all of this up.
You put her there to distract Amos, and you shot him from behind. This isn't just something that happened, and you did the best you could, and poor fucking Wei, you did this. If Mr. Burton here had done as he was asked and left the site... He was trying to save us, Faez shouted.
His face was red, and he stepped forward. His hands were in fists at his sides. Murtry looked up, something a little less than polite interest in his eyes.
He and Holden are trying to save us. You and me and Elvi and everyone, what the hell are you doing?
I'm protecting the assets, rights, and claims of Royal Charter Energy, Murtry said. What I'm not doing, and I hope you understand this, is running around in a circle with my dick in my hand, whining about how nothing matters because we're all going to die.
We all knew when we got on the Edward Israel that we might not make it back. That was a risk you were willing to take because it meant you could do your job. I'm no different.
You got Wei killed,
Faez shouted. Elvi put her hand on his shoulder and he shrugged it off.
She's dead because of you.
Her turn now, my turn later, Murtry said. But there are some things I need to get done before that.
The security chief checked his gun and looked down at Amos Burton, staring raw hatred up at him. Murtry leveled the barrel at the bleeding man's face.
Look away, Elvi thought. Don't watch this happen. Look away.
Faez hit Murtry in the nose. The movement was so fast and awkward and artless that at first Elvi wasn't sure it had really happened. She watched the expression in Faez's widening eyes as he understood what he'd done, and then when he committed to doing it again. Murtry turned his pistol away from Amos, swinging it toward Faez, and the geologist ran into him with a shout. Murtry stumbled back but didn't fall.
Elvi! Faez shouted. Run!
She took a step forward. Amos was writhing on the ground, blood pouring from somewhere in his suit. His teeth were bared and crimson. He was grinning.
Run!
Faez screamed. The great gray walls rose around them, false stars glittering. She couldn't breathe. She took one tentative step forward, then another. She felt like she was moving through a gel, forcing every motion.
Shock, she thought. I'm in shock. People die from shock, don't they?
In her memory, Faez shook his head and said,
Oh, look, another excuse to go talk to Holden.
Holden. She had to find Holden. She took another step, then another, and then she was sprinting, her legs and arms pumping, small animal grunts forcing their way out of her throat. Somewhere behind her, a pistol fired twice, and then a third time. She didn't look back. Everything in her, everything she was, focused only forward, along the wide, dark veins of the structure, forward to where they converged. Elvi ran.
Chapter 51. Baja. Baja reached out to touch the tether, and it vibrated under his gloved fingers like a living thing.
Alex, Naomi didn't quite yell over the general comm channel.
I'm sending you a burn program. You have to keep that cable taut until Baja cuts it, or the barb is going to rip us both apart.
I'm not cutting it,
Baja repeated, but no one replied. He checked to see if his microphone was on.
One, Havelock said, ending his countdown. Out of time, guys.
If the security man's threats had any effect, Baja couldn't tell. His HUD was still displaying the red lines of incoming gunfire. He ignored them. Above him, the Rosinante began shifting and firing its remaining maneuvering thrusters in response to the slow rotation of the Barba Piccola, desperately trying to keep slack out of the cable. Two massive ships, each rotating in different axes, the cable could go from slack to thousands of tons of tension fast enough to tear the mounts out of the ships and a chunk of the ship's structure along with it.
Baja, Naomi said, her voice gentle. I can't give you much time, and you know this ends the same way no matter what.
I'm checking the connection to the barb, he said instead of answering her.
The mount was a mess of twisted metal and frayed cable. Pieces of the hull had been torn free by dislodged footings, and the ones that were still connected stretched and flexed with each gyration of the ship. Baja tried to calculate how much tension must be on the rigging and cable, and failed. If it snapped free, it would probably cut him in half. If he did cut it, he'd need Alex to put slack on it first.
"I'm not cutting it," he said again, more to himself than anyone else.
Cutting it meant letting the barb drift away, down into the upper atmosphere to rip apart and burn, to let Felsia burn. Alex had promised not to let that happen. A pair of red lines drew themselves across his HUD, and the words "danger close" flashed there briefly. He wasn't up on all his military jargon, but he could guess what that phrase meant. He pulled himself around the cable footing and took cover. Out in the blackness between the Israel and the barb, 12 men in suits floated toward him on puffs of gas. They still had a few of their improvised missiles.
"Guys," Havelock said, real sadness in his voice.
"Havelock," Naomi yelled. "If you let those assholes shoot Baja, you don't get to come back on my ship."
"Roger that," Havelock said sorrowfully.
One of the 12 attackers spun sideways as a puff of white mist shot out of his EVA pack. The man continued to rotate wildly as he flew at high speed away from the others.
"One of you should go get him," Havelock said. "His EVA pack is toast."
Almost before he finished saying it, two of the remaining attackers jetted toward the disabled man, bringing their grapnel guns to bear.
"Havelock, you asshole," Kunin said on the open frequency where everyone could hear him. "I'm going to enjoy stomping a mud hole in you."
He and his team opened fire on Havelock's position in the airlock, driving him back into cover. Now that everyone wasn't looking at him, Baja took a moment to look over the mangled footing.
"Naomi, I'm having the suit send you pictures of the damage."
"Baja, I..."
she started.
"Help me fix this," he said, cutting her off.
"If the barb has more cable, I can reattach it here while Alex keeps us from totally losing our remaining connection."
"Baja," Naomi said, her voice gentle and sad.
"This can't be fixed. The Barbapacola is going down. Nothing is gained by her taking us with her."
"I do not accept that,"
Baja shouted back at her, loud enough that his own suit speakers distorted.
"There has to be a way."
His suit flashed a warning at him, and he pulled back into cover just in time to avoid a fusillade of shots that bounced off the hull, leaving shiny streaks in the dull metal. One of the remaining 9 attackers threw his arms up like he was surrendering, then went motionless, spinning slowly toward the Barbapacola.
"Williams is flatlined," the chief engineer said. "You just killed an RCE employee. You'll burn for that, Havelock."
"You know what, chief? Fuck you," Havelock replied, his tone low but real anger in his voice for the first time.
"You're the one who escalated this. I didn't ask for any of it. Pull out. Marwick, get your men out of here. Don't let him force this anymore."
Another voice, older, sadder, replied on the radio.
"Those aren't my men, Mr. Havelock. You know as well as I do that I have no authority over the expeditionary team."
"That's right, motherfucker," the chief said. "We're acting on orders from Chief of Security Murtry."
While Havelock, Marwick, and the chief engineer argued, Baja tuned them out. They'd either agree or they wouldn't. Havelock would kill more of them, or he wouldn't. The captain would assert authority, or he wouldn't. None of that changed Baja's real problem. His daughter was on board a ship that was slowly spinning out of control and losing altitude. At some point, it would hit enough atmosphere to get noticeable drag, which would slow it and let it fall deeper into the killing air. And shortly after that, it would burn up. The Rocinante couldn't save it. Helplessness and grief washed over him, but he willed himself not to weep. He wouldn't be able to see with the water sheeting across his eyes. There had to be another way. "Baja," Naomi said in a private channel to him. He could tell she'd switched him to a private channel because the argument between Havelock and the RCE people stopped suddenly mid-word. "Baja, I'm getting your daughter out." "What?" "I'm on the line with the captain of the Barbapacola. I've explained the situation. He's not happy, but he understands. Alex promised you that if the ships went down, Felsi would be on the Rocinante when it happened. We're keeping that promise."
"How?"
Baja asked. The way the ships were tumbling, he couldn't imagine how dangerous a docking attempt would be. The ship-to-ship docking tubes were flexible, but not that flexible. "They're bringing her to the airlock now. They'll put her in a suit and send her out to you. You'll need to get her back to this ship, and then you need to cut the cable." Something about the docking tube stuck in his mind. The Rocinante couldn't dock with the Barbapacola to pull the doomed crew off, but a spacesuit was, at heart, just a bubble of air to keep its wearer alive.
"The docking tube," he said. "Is there a way to seal it on both ends? We could put it on the barb, seal it around some people, then move them across to the Rossi."
"We'd have to cut it free from the airlock housing," Naomi said. A spray of bullets hit the cable footing as she spoke, like visual punctuation for her words. Another of the engineers spun away, his EVA pack holed in two places. Naomi continued talking, but Baja wasn't listening.
"What about emergency airlocks?" he said. "The plastic blister kind, you know? They're made to hold atmosphere and supply oxygen."
"You have to attach them to something," Naomi said.
"What if," Baja answered, "we attach them to each other, seal to seal?"
Naomi was silent for a long moment. When she spoke again, her words were slow, measured, like she was thinking them through as she spoke. "A life support bubble." Baja could tell she'd switched them back to the general channel because Havelock's argument came thundering back.
"Gentlemen, we have an idea. We'll pull the crew off the Barbapacola on escape pods made of two emergency airlocks sealed together. The Rossi only carries one, but if the barb has one..."
"You're kidding me?"
a new voice said. Baja recognized it. The captain of the Belter ship.
"I think somebody turned ours into parts for a still back before we shot the Pinche Ring."
"We have plenty of them," Havelock said. "The Israel came out here with too much of everything. I'd bet we have 20 in storage."
"That's 10 bubbles," Baja said. "That's plenty to hold the whole crew for a short trip."
"Captain Marwick," Kernan said, "you cannot give these people vital RCE supplies."
"Marwick," Havelock said, "do not let over 100 innocent people die over this bullshit. Do not do that."
"Oh, fuck.
What are they going to do, cancel my contract?"
Marwick replied, followed by a long sigh.
"The Israel is moving in to transfer the escape bubbles. I'll have the materials team start sealing them right now."
"Captain," the chief engineer growled, "we are acting out here on Security Chief Murtry's direct orders to disable the squatter's ship. You will not render them aid."
"You," Havelock said, "are such an asshole. Have you gone completely insane?"
"I will shoot down any attempt to..."
the chief started, then stopped suddenly. The cable next to Baja snapped taut, almost tearing the few remaining attachments out of the barbed skin. Below, a railgun shot streaked across Illis, the fire from the defense moons stabbing at it as it fell. One of the red enemy dots on Baja's HUD disappeared.
Sorry, Alex said. His accent as slow and heavy as Baji had ever heard it. That was me. But that guy was pissing me off, and I had the shot. Am I in trouble?
There was a long moment of silence. Then Captain Marwick said,
Israel's on her way.
It took them nearly 3 hours to fabricate and then transfer the makeshift escape bubbles from the Israel. Baja kept track of the time by counting oxygen recharges for his suit. He flatly refused to return to the Rocinante until his daughter was off the dying Belter freighter. Alex had put some slack on the tether with carefully calculated bursts of thrust, and Baja had cut the line. No reason to keep the ships connected. One by one, the Israel's expeditionary engineering team turned amateur militia contacted Havelock and apologized for how dramatically out of control the situation had gotten. Most of them blamed the chief engineer. Whether or not he was entirely responsible for the escalations that had occurred, Baja felt certain that history wouldn't remember him kindly. One of the engineers admitted to being the person who'd fired the missile at the Barbapakola and offered to help Baja fix the damage. Baja had offered to kill him if he tried. They agreed to disagree on it. Even after the reconfigured emergency airlocks had been delivered, it had taken the crew of the Barbapakola and the colonists still on board 2 more hours to charge the air tanks and get everyone sealed inside. By that point, the computers on the Rocinante were saying the freighter should already be scraping upper atmosphere. The clock had run out. But now, Baja floated above the massive cargo bay doors of the Barbapakola, waiting for them to open, and set his daughter free. It began as a line of white light cutting through the side of the massive freighter. Then, slowly, as the doors slid farther and farther apart, the ship's enormous cargo hold came into view. Against the backdrop of thousands of tons of raw lithium ore floated 10 faintly translucent bubbles. Someone toggled a remote to open the cargo bay's airlock, and the air of the Barbapakola rushed out, gently pushing the bubbles out the cargo bay door ahead of it. The bubbles floated up away from the planet, the vacuum around them making them puff all the way up, little plump pockets of air for a dozen or more people to hide in, surrounded by the frozen mist of what had once been their ship's atmosphere. Illis's star peeked around the limb of the planet, backlighting the bubbles and turning the floating people inside into black silhouettes, amazingly sharp against the blurry plastic walls, like cardboard cutouts with a floodlight behind them. Baja had a sudden memory of bathing Jacek in the kitchen sink when he was a baby, and his little boy farting in the water, a burst of small bubbles drifting up and then popping at the surface. He recognized this was more about the relief that his daughter might live than it was about the flatulence of a small boy, but he laughed anyway. You okay out there? Naomi asked. You ever bathed a kid in the sink? Yeah, she said, I have. They ever have gas? I don't, she started, then got it and laughed along with him. 10 tow lines looped down from the open airlock of the Israel, and one by one, Baja caught them and attached them to the bubbles. Felsia's bubble was last. As he pulled the strip at the end of the tether to activate the adhesive, he saw her look out of the airlock door's tiny transparent window. The sun had moved behind the planet, so Baja's visor had lost its opacity. He activated the light inside the helmet so she'd be able to see him. Her face lit up, and the word Papa was so obvious on her lips that he would have sworn he could hear it. Hi, baby, he said, and put his gloved hand against the window. She put hers on the other side, small, clever fingers against his big, clumsy ones. She smiled and pointed past him, mouthing the word, Wow. He turned to look. The Israel had started reeling the bubbles in one by one. A dozen humans being pulled through the vacuum of space inside an envelope of air barely larger than they were. When Felsia's line started to reel in, Bajja kept his hand against it until it pulled gently, gently away from him. His little girl, going up to safety. Temporary, sure, but all safety was. In that moment, Bajja felt something like a hammer blow to his chest. Everyone in those little pockets of air was a Felsia to someone. Every life saved there filled someone somewhere else with relief and joy. Every life snuffed out before its time was another Katoa. Someone, somewhere, having their heart torn out. Bajja could feel the detonator in his hands, the horrible click transferring to his palm as the button depressed. He could feel that terrible shockwave again as the landing pad vanished in fire. He could feel the horror replaced by fear as some unlucky combination of events put the shuttle too close to the blast and knocked it from the sky. He could feel all of it so clearly, it was as if it were happening right then. But more than that, he felt sorrow. Someone had just tried to do the same thing to his baby girl. Had tried to kill her, not because he hated her, but because she was standing in the path of his political statement. Everyone who died on that shuttle had been a Felsia to someone. And with the click of a button, he'd killed them. He hadn't meant to. He'd been trying to save them. That was the little lie he'd kept close to his heart for months now. But the truth was much worse. Some secret part of him had wanted the shuttle to die, had reveled in watching it fall from the sky in flames, had wanted to punish the people who were trying to take his world away. Except that was a lie, too. The real truth, the truth beneath it all, was he'd wanted to spread his pain around. To punish the universe for being a place where his little boy had been killed. To punish other people for being alive when his Katoa wasn't. That part of him had watched the shuttle burn and thought, now you know how it feels. Now you know how I feel. But the people he'd hurt had just saved his daughter. Because they were the kind of people who couldn't let even their enemies die helpless. The first sob took him by surprise, nearly bending him double with its power. Then he was blind, his eyes filled with water, his throat closed like someone was choking him. He gasped for air, and every gasp turned into another loud sob. Bajja, Naomi said in alarm. He'd just been cackling maniacally, and now he was sobbing. He must sound insane to her. Bajja, come back in. He tried to answer her, to reassure her, but when he spoke, the only words he could say were, I killed them. No, she said. You saved them. You saved all of them. I killed them, he said again. And he meant the governor, and Coop, and Kate, and the RCE security team. But most of all, Katoa. He'd killed his little boy over and over again, every time he'd let someone else die to punish them for his son's death. I killed them, he said again. This time you saved them, Naomi repeated, as though she could read his mind. These ones, you saved. Havelock was waiting for him in the airlock. Bajja knew the RCE man must have heard the breakdown he'd had. When Havelock looked at him, he felt nothing but shame. But while Havelock's face was tight with pain, there was no mockery in it when he gripped Bajja's arm and said, You did good out there. Bajja nodded back at him, not trusting himself to speak. Look, Havelock said and pointed out the airlock door. Baja turned around